Welcome to the 35th episode of Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Brandon Scalia. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. Onc Live is also home to the State of the Science Summits. These summits, which take place throughout the United States, are dedicated to the latest research in various therapeutic areas. That brings us to today's episode. Recently, we traveled to Pasadena, California for a State of the Science Summit on genitourinary malignancies. At the meeting, faculty from City of Hope, Huntsman Cancer Center, and the University of Washington discussed the rapidly evolving landscapes of kidney, bladder, and prostate cancers. Since the meeting, there have been several FDA decisions, including the February 15, 2019, priority review designation to a supplemental biologics license application for the combination of pembrolizumab and axitinib as a frontline treatment for patients with advanced renal cell carcinoma. The application is primarily based on data from the Phase 3 KEYNOTE-426 study, which showed a 47% reduction in the risk of death with the combination versus single-agent sunitinib. Moreover, the FDA granted a priority review designation to a supplemental biologics license application for the combination of avelumab and axitinib as a treatment for patients with advanced renal cell carcinoma. Findings from the Phase 3 JAVELIN Renal 101 trial, which were presented at the 2018 ESMO Congress, served as the basis for this regulatory decision. Results showed that the combination significantly improved progression-free survival and doubled objective response rates compared with sunitinib in patients with treatment-naive advanced renal cell carcinoma, irrespective of PD-L1 expression. First, we spoke with the chair of the meeting, Petros Grivas, MD, PhD, who underscored the importance of clinical trials for patients with locally advanced or metastatic bladder cancer who are cisplatin ineligible. Grivas is the director of the Genitourinary Cancers Program and an associate professor in the Department of Medicine and the Division of Oncology at the University of Washington School of Medicine. He also serves as a medical oncologist at the Seattle Cancer Care Alliance. In our interview, Grivas highlighted the treatment options available for patients with locally advanced and metastatic disease.
It's a really exciting era in management of bladder cancer, and in the localized disease setting, so far we have had cisplatin-based neoadjuvant chemotherapy with level 1 evidence before radical cystectomy and lymph node dissection. However, many patients may not be fit enough to get cisplatin, and there is an unmet need in those cisplatin-unfit patients who right now they go right to the operating room to get radical cystectomy because there's no good evidence with carboplatin or other agents unless it's cisplatin-based. So to try to meet this unmet need, we now have designed clinical trials, for example, trials with immune checkpoint inhibitors, immunotherapy, to try to evaluate the activity of those agents measured by pathologic complete response rates. And we have data by the Abacus trial presented at ASCO this year by Dr. Powles, showing 29 pathologic complete response rate, not 29%, at pathologic complete response rate in patients getting just 2 doses of atezolizumab followed by radical cystectomy. And if you look at the subset of patients with higher PD-L1 expression, this pathologic complete response rate went up to 40%, and 29% was in all comers. Similar data by Dr. Necki and colleagues at ASCO and ESMO this year with pembrolizumab, 3 doses before radical cystectomy and lymph node dissection, all comers, pathologic complete response rates, it was about 40%, and was even higher, about 50% in those with higher PD-L1 expression. These data were not practice changing, but definitely fuel enthusiasm and definitely feed significant attention to immunotherapy neoadjuvant trials. And that's what we try to do in our institution and other institutions, to look for these immunotherapy agents, especially in these cisplatin unfit ineligible patients, and see whether we can have some new treatment option down the road for them if these trials are confirming activity and safety. At the same time, we can even build upon cisplatin backbone, and there are now new trials looking at cisplatin plus immunotherapy versus, you know, cisplatin-based therapy alone. That's something that should probably is going to be looked at in the near future trying to improve upon outcomes in patients with localized disease. At the same time, you have patients who come to us with a radical cystectomy and they never received neoadjuvant chemotherapy, or they received it and they still have muscle invasive residual disease. Those patients, you know, if they cannot, if they never received neoadjuvant chemotherapy before, if they are fit for cisplatin, because they never had it before, and they had PT3 or PT4 or node positive disease, we tend to offer them cisplatin-based adjuvant chemotherapy in that setting. However, if they cannot get cisplatin safely or refuse it, or they already had received it neoadjuvantly, we have these immunotherapy clinical trials, and we discuss today some of those trials looking at immune checkpoint inhibitor as single agent in the adjuvant setting after radical cystectomy lymph node dissection, and we try to accrue well in those adjuvant immunotherapy trials. I think the last point I will make is about bladder preservation, and there is significant effort to improve upon the data with bladder preservation nowadays, and we use concurrent chemotherapy and radiation, chemo radiation as a backbone, and we have this intergroup trial with SWOG, NRG, ECOG Akron Alliance, who all came together. We designed a study looking at chemo radiation alone or chemo radiation plus atezolizumab, an anti-PD-L1 agent, to see whether the combination could improve upon bladder intact, disease-free survival, and many other endpoints. And potentially this trial, if it accrues well, will give us more data about bladder preservation down the road. I cannot emphasize enough the role and importance of biomarkers. And those trials, especially neoadjuvant trials, give us tissue before and after immunotherapy, blood and urine, so plethora of biospecimens to do research studies and to look at biomarkers that can help biomarker discovery and validation. We have to align more endpoints there in terms of which biomarkers we should look as an oncology community and get smarter and hopefully select the right treatment for the right patient down the road.
Next, we sat down with Jonathan L. Wright, MD, MS, FACS, Medical Director of the University of Washington Medical Center Urology Clinic and Associate Professor of Urology at the University of Washington. He is also an affiliate investigator at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center. In our interview, Wright explained that one of the continual challenges in localized muscle-invasive bladder cancer is determining whether or not patients should receive neoadjuvant chemotherapy. When faced with this decision, he explained that proper patient selection ultimately boils down to two factors, disease stage and cisplatin eligibility. Listen on to hear Wright shed light on the available therapies for patients with localized muscle-invasive bladder cancer.
Yeah, ideally, the main thing we want to have is a patient who has muscle-invasive or locally advanced T3, T4, and or node-positive disease who are eligible primarily to receive cisplatinum. And that includes having an adequate renal function and no significant hearing loss, peripheral neuropathy, etc. The main thing is we want to identify patients who are eligible for cisplatinum primarily based on renal function as the best treatment in the neoadjuvant setting. Primarily, if you're not eligible for cisplatin-based neoadjuvant chemotherapy, we recommend upfront cystectomy. There are cases where we will use alternative agents, but in general, if they're not cisplatinum eligible, we prefer upfront cystectomy, with the use of carboplatin being an inferior option for patients.
After taking the stage, Sumanta Kumar Pal, MD, a medical oncologist at City of Hope, said that although VEGF TKIs have long defined the frontline standard of care in metastatic renal cell carcinoma, several promising trials evaluating their use in combination with immunotherapy agents may redefine the frontline setting for this patient population. Hear from Pat on the different combination regimens that are making headlines in the treatment of patients with metastatic renal cell carcinoma.
Today I basically talked about frontline therapy for metastatic renal cell carcinoma. Lots of big developments in therapy over the course of the past year with trials looking at nivolumab and ipilimumab, bevacizumab, atezolizumab, axitinib, avelumab. Basically, in principle, combinations of immunotherapy with immunotherapy or immunotherapy with targeted agents. So nivolumab and ipilimumab, very appropriate regimen for selected patients, but there are a couple of caveats. First of all, probably not best for patients with good risk disease. The data from CheckMate 214 really suggests that good risk patients by IMDC classification probably don't do as well with Nivo and Ipi versus TKIs. Furthermore, for patients where, for instance, you have concerns regarding autoimmune conditions, for patients where there are concerns around whether or not available therapies and consultants may be available for managing autoimmune conditions, those are scenarios where I might shy away from the regimen as well in favor of a TKI like cabozantinib.
Next, we spoke with Neeraj Agarwal, MD, an associate professor in the Division of Oncology and Department of Medicine at the University of Utah School of Medicine. He also serves as director of the Genitourinary Oncology Program in the Oncology Division and co-leader of the Urologic Oncology Multidisciplinary Program and the associate director of clinical trials at Huntsman Cancer Institute. With more than 11 therapies approved by the FDA for the treatment of patients with metastatic renal cell carcinoma, sequencing therapies has become a challenge. Listen to Agarwal discuss his preferred sequencing strategies for patients with metastatic disease who progress on frontline therapy.
My talk was on how to sequence 11 or more agents which are now approved for patients with metastatic renal cell carcinoma. It's amazing to see how much has changed in the last 10 years. Just 10, 11 years ago, all we had were interferon or high-dose interleukin therapy. And since the approval of sorafenib, which was the first VEGF TKI approved for these patients, we have seen more than 10 agents getting approved, and we continue to see new approvals every 6 months now. So it's very challenging regarding how to sequence these agents, how to maximize the efficacy of these agents and to improve the overall survival and quality of life for our patients. So I would divide these agents into three major classes, or maybe four. Agents which are targeting VEGF. So VEGF TKIs or VEGF antibodies like sunitinib, pazopanib, sorafenib, or bevacizumab. The second class of drug is the second generation VEGF inhibitors, which also have activity against other tyrosine kinase receptors, receptor tyrosine kinases, such as cabozantinib, which also inhibit AXL and c-MET, or lenvatinib, which also inhibit FGFR, which is considered to be one of the redundant or resistance mechanism for VEGF blockade. And then third category is mTOR inhibitor or inhibitors of mammalian target of rapamycin, which are no longer used anymore in these patients, for most of these patients. And the fourth, which is the most novel class, is the checkpoint inhibitors, including ipilimumab, a CTLA-4 inhibitor, and nivolumab, which is a PD-1 inhibitor. So I'll focus on sequencing because, as you know, Dr. Montipal presented the first part, like how to use the first-line therapy in these patients. So as far as sequencing is concerned, I always want to remind myself of the data from the International Metastatic Renal Cell Carcinoma Consortium led by Dr. Tony Shuri at Dana-Farber and Dr. Danny Heng. And these data are very telling. They just published, I'm a part of that consortium, we just published a paper which basically shows how many patients, real-world patients, actually are able to get second-line therapy and how many patients get to third-line therapy. And the results were very telling. They started with more than 7,000 patients who were newly diagnosed and received first-line therapy for metastatic RCC, and only 50% patients received second-line therapy. By the time we were talking about fourth-line therapy, less than 8% patients actually received fourth-line therapy. So the message I got from these data was that we need to use the most effective therapy at a given time point for a given patient. Otherwise, it is very much possible that patient may not see the second-line therapy or third-line therapy, may not be alive to see the subsequent line of therapy. So based on that, when I look at somebody who has progressed on a VEGF TKI, and I want to use the most effective second-line therapy, or like salvage therapy, as I would call. I would call it salvage therapy because all these agents are not only approved for first-line failure patients, they're approved for patients who have progressed in multiple lines of therapies. So for example, if somebody is progressing on first-line VEGF TKI, or first-line immunotherapy. The best drug I can think of is cabozantinib, which is an inhibitor of VEGF tyrosine kinase and a c-MET and AXL tyrosine kinase, tyrosine kinases. And as a monotherapy, cabozantinib still is associated with the longest progression-free survival in the second-line or third-line therapy setting. And that is very important for me, because progression-free survival, a long progression-free survival means the patient is going to be alive for that long, and also is more likely to see the subsequent line of therapy.
Transitioning to prostate cancer, Tanya B. Dorf, MD, an associate clinical professor in the Department of Medical Oncology and Therapeutics Research and head of the genitourinary cancers program at City of Hope, discussed landmark approvals in non-metastatic castration-resistant prostate cancer. These approvals have established the foundation for subsequent progress for patients with non-metastatic CRPC, she said. Dorf also anticipated developments to be made in metastatic castration-resistant prostate cancer by way of immunotherapy, PARP inhibitors, and imaging techniques.
For non-metastatic castration-resistant prostate cancer, there were two landmark studies presented, which now have changed the way we practice. So first and foremost, it's really important to image patients whose PSA is rising despite castration therapy so that we can correctly categorize them as metastatic or non-metastatic, and even to the finer points, oligometastatic versus large volume metastatic. But when we do find patients who are truly non-metastatic castration resistant, we can't find anything on conventional imaging. The next thing we need to do is check a doubling time to categorize them again as high risk or not as high risk. So we use a PSA doubling time cutoff of less than or equal to 10 months. That's what was used in both of the trials. So if a patient meets all those criteria, then we now have treatment options, whereas before we really didn't. We used to do some secondary hormonal manipulations, but there was nothing that we really knew would improve their survival. So both apalutamide and enzalutamide were studied in large randomized trials showing a positive primary endpoint of metastasis-free survival. So this is a new endpoint for the prostate cancer community, but it led to the FDA approval of these drugs in this context and is really clinically meaningful and I think resonates with patients as well. The choice between apalutamide and enzalutamide, we don't really have comparative data, so either one is a perfectly acceptable option. There are some slight differences in side effect profile, but generally speaking, there's no major reason to choose one or the other. Quality of life, based on additional data that have been presented, seem to be maintained on these drugs, which is important. And then the other major thing to emphasize is that fractures were seen on one of the studies, and we have to think these men have been castrated for quite a while and are going to continue on castration therapy. So we really have to pay attention to bone supportive therapy when we're treating men in this earlier disease setting. In this space, it's hard to see where we'll go. I think what's really coming in this space is imaging. So a lot of people believe that as we get more sensitive PET scans, we will no longer categorize patients as non-metastatic, castration-resistant. We know the cancer cells are there, so it's really semantics. We know they're metastatic. It's just a question of, are they micrometastatic or are they macro, where we can see it on imaging. So as gallium PSMA and other PSMA agents come into clinical availability, I think this population will actually shrink, and so we'll be looking more at metastatic hormone sensitive as the new frontier to try new agents in upfront intensification. And of course, genomic characterization is the other big paradigm shifter that should be coming into the mainstream relatively soon once we have approval of agents designed or effective for specific molecular subclasses.
Finally, we sat down with Evan Yu, MD, professor in the Department of Medical Oncology at the University of Washington School of Medicine, and a clinical trials core director, genitourinary medical oncology, at the Seattle Cancer Care Alliance. He claimed that the CHARTED, STAMPEDE, and LATITUDE trials have manifested in a dramatic clinical benefit for patients with metastatic castration-naive prostate cancer, enabling physicians to turn their attention toward those with oligometastatic disease earlier detection, and the potential for metastatic therapy.
Today, I'm talking about castration-naive metastatic prostate cancer. Now, this is a disease state where we are seeing more and more of this as time goes on, partially because there's less PSA screening. But as a result of that, what we're seeing are patients with an unmet need. And recently, there's been quite a bit of exciting data looking at adding to standard androgen deprivation therapy. For instance, we've seen that docetaxel chemotherapy has led to a dramatic survival benefit when added to androgen deprivation therapy in both the CHARTED and the STAMPEDE trials. And abiraterone acetate with prednisone, when added to androgen deprivation therapy, also adds a dramatic survival benefit in both the LATITUDE and also an arm in the STAMPEDE trial. So this leads to a little bit of a clinical dilemma in which one asks, should we be using docetaxel or abiraterone? And at this point in time, there are a few things that I think are clear. Is one that for high volume or high risk metastatic disease, and how high volume was defined in the CHARTED trial was 4 or more bone metastases with at least one outside the axial skeleton or visceral lesions, that those patients clearly gain survival benefit from docetaxel, but it's not clear that the low volume disease patients do. At the same time, with abiraterone acetate, there's clear data that shows that high-volume patients and also high-risk patients from the LATITUDE trial get survival benefit from abiraterone acetate. High-risk being defined as 2 of 3 criteria, either Gleason 8 or greater. You had to have either 3 or more bone metastases or visceral lesions, and you had to have 2 of those 3 criteria. Now, the one thing that's interesting and unique with abiraterone acetate is that when you look at the data with low volume or low risk disease, which has been done in post hoc analyses recently presented at ESMO, what we see is that there is clear survival benefit as well. So I think in summary, what I tend to do is I tend to take patients who have high volume metastatic disease and I offer them either docetaxel or abiraterone, looking at comorbidities, side effects, cost issues, practicality issues, and help make a decision there. I see maybe about half my patients opt for docetaxel, half opt for abiraterone. For low volume disease patients, I feel the data is stronger and I offer abiraterone. Now, the next component of my talk is kind of looking towards the future. And that is really looking at the new arising data with oligometastatic treatments. We already have data in colon cancer and other cancers like lung cancer, but it's not clear in prostate cancer yet. But there are ongoing trials that are going to be done. And some of these trials also look at eradicating the primary lesion of the prostate. Now, one might think theoretically there's rationale there because the primary will shed lesions, micrometastases that'll set down and create more metastases, and the metastases also shed to create even more metastases. So ablating those at a lower volume disease state might be ideal. And with that being said and done, there are studies already that are reading out looking at ablating the primary prostate lesion when you have somebody with metastatic disease. The HORAD trial was negative for those with high volume disease or high PSA, is greater than 20 with the median PSA in the 50s. But that being said and done, there was an arm in the STAMPEDE trial where they did do lower doses of radiation, like 55 gray over 4 weeks, to the prostate, and in the subgroup analysis, it showed a survival benefit. Overall, still a negative study, but that subgroup analysis leads to the strong hypothesis that maybe we ought to ablate the primary lesion, even in patients who have very low volume metastases, and maybe we ought to also ablate oligometastases. So as the field moves more towards next generation imaging modalities with new PET imaging, like PSMA PET, like flucyclovine PET, we're gonna find kind of really, really low volume disease, and that's exciting because maybe if we do primary ablation and ablate those oligometastases, we might not only improve survival outcomes, we might actually cure some more people.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to the 35th episode of OncLive On Air. Check back on Wednesdays for new interviews from our State of the Science Summits. For more updates on oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. We have 2 upcoming State of the Science Summits for those interested in attending. If you'd like to review the latest advances made in hematologic malignancies, register for the April 11th State of the Science Summit in Boston, Massachusetts. We'll also be holding a State of the Science Summit on lung cancer on April 16th in Dallas, Texas. Register now at onclive.com/meetings/SOSS. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and at OncLiveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you like today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.